I am Plant on the Line. This is thecommentary.ca. The award-winning and internationally syndicated columnist Eric Margolies joins me now here in Vancouver. He's the author of a new book, American Raj, Liberation or Domination. It sheds light on the West and its relationship with the Muslim world. After decades of traveling throughout the world, especially in the Middle East, Margolies provides a first-hand view of how we got to where we are and how the centuries-old conflict can be resolved. Among the points discussed in the book, why is there so much anger between the West and the Muslim world? Why is Al-Qaeda so popular, and how can it be defeated? As well, views on Afghanistan, Iran, and Pakistan, and how what happens there affects us. And we'll look at the current election campaigns in this country and in the United States and see how they will affect the Middle East and the Muslim world. I'll also ask Mr. Margolies about meeting Osama bin Laden. EricMargolies.com is his website. In Canada, you can read him in the Toronto Sun, where he's its foreign correspondent. The book American Raj is published by Key Porter and retails for $32.95. Please welcome to the Planta on the Line program, Eric Margolies. Good morning, Mr. Margolies.
Good morning to you.
Thanks for joining us. You met Osama bin Laden in 1986, did you?
I met him in the early 1990s, let's say. We didn't have a formal meeting, but our paths crossed in Afghanistan.
What struck you about him? I read something, a column that you'd written, I guess about a week or so ago. He was a man of little consequence, you thought?
I was in a room with about 20 other mujahideen, or as we used to call them, freedom fighters, who've been fighting against the Soviets and their communist Afghan allies. And he was a volunteer who had come from the Middle East. I noticed him only because he did not look like an Afghan, and he clearly looked to my mind, like he came from Yemen or the southern part of Saudi Arabia. And I exchanged a few words with him in Arabic. I remember him only because he was tall and he had a very striking physical resemblance, and he looked very quiet and very thoughtful and pensive. But at that point, he was just another one of our freedom fighters, and there was nothing remarkable about him beyond that.
Do you think we in the West sort of ignored the Muslim world or never thought of it in its influence until after September 11th?
Very certainly. People think that what we call terrorism, all this violence began with September 11th. It didn't. September 11th was really the culmination of 200 years of Western colonial rule and neo-modern colonial rule in the Muslim world, to the point, as I bring out in my new book, American Raj, that this is part of a historical continuity, and that even now much of the Muslim world remains in a sort of a semi-colonial state, though not directly ruled by the Western powers. It's ruled by dictators and kings and various despots and military men who were put into power, or kept in power, by the West, and who, in the Muslim view at least, exploit the Muslim world.
Raj, that's an Indian word, is it?
Raj is an Indian word, and it means kingdom or empire. That's how the British rule of India was called, the British Raj in India. I use the title for American Raj because America really has inherited the British Indian Raj, in a sense, not India, but in the Muslim world. America dominates the Muslim world much as the British dominated India, and that is not so much for having troops on the ground, though it does in some places, but primarily having useful captive rulers who do Washington's bidding and help in the economic exploitation of the area.
And that economic exploitation, that's at the root of the anger that they feel towards the West.
Well, right? it's one of the reasons. But there's a great sense across the Muslim world that they are the victims of injustice and that they have to resist Western influence. And I try and point out in my book that the primary cause of this is Western-backed dictatorial regimes, what we call terrorism, is really violent reaction against these regimes, who are the primary targets of terrorism, not the West. But there are other burning issues that continue to inflame Muslim opinion and feed on each other, such as the conflict over Palestine, Lebanon, Chechnya, Iraq, Afghanistan, and so on. And I discuss each one of these in my book and analyze it and try to show the way the Muslims see these issues and why they make the Muslim world so angry.
And the idea of a Western-style democracy, a secular sort of Muslim, but a secular sort of democracy in the Middle East, is that ever possible, do you think?
Oh, I think it is possible. The problem is that we've had only two free elections in, I don't count Israel, which is a democracy, but in the Arab states, anyway, only two free elections. One was in Algeria in 1992, and the Islamists won the election, and the next election was annulled, and martial law declared, and all the leaders of the Islamist party locked up with U.S. and French backing. The second was in Gaza, where Hamas won a free election, and the result was the U.S. and Israel immediately put Gaza under blockade and tried to starve it out to change the course of the vote. Democracy means having to accept people you do not like and to listen to things you can't abide and to go with the will of the people. We want what we call democracy, which is putting the people that we approve and who are obedient to our Western wishes in power. That's not real democracy.
Do you see a movement away from that, though? I'm just wondering, considering the American election, if there's a change there?
I have long seen in my 50 years of travels across the Muslim world an earnest desire for real, genuine democracy and social justice. That means decent courts, care for people. You know, the reason the Islamic extremists have done so well is because the governments in these countries don't give a damn about their own people. The Islamic parties have provided social welfare. They feed people, they take care of orphans, old folks, they clean the streets, they have schools. They are the real governments of these countries. There's a yearning for justice, there's a yearning for democracy in many of these countries, but unfortunately what's happened is that the Western-backed regimes have ferociously jailed or killed or driven out any people who speak as moderate voices for democracy in order to keep an iron control of these countries. So the political center has been completely squashed, leaving either the government or the underground extreme.
So how does that change? How do we get away from that?
It changes when we start supporting governments that have a popular mandate. And in my book, I do a survey of the Muslim states country by country, and I show that almost every one of them are ruled by non-representative, non-legitimate countries. But these are our Western overseers in our plantations, and we have got to accept or loosen our political control, and I mean really U.S. political control and French and British to a lesser degree of the region, and accept that it's time to allow the region to start growing up politically.
And whoever wins in November, whether that be McCain or Obama, will we see that change sort of precipitate?
Unfortunately not.
Even under Obama?
Even under Obama. I think both Obama and McCain have made perfectly clear that in their foreign policy in terms of the Muslim world is going to be more of the same. It's going to be a continuation of Bush's policy. The powers that be in Washington, the special interests, have really got these two candidates in handcuffs. What this means is that there is likely going to be no settlement between the Arabs and Israel, which is tragic. Even Israel's outgoing prime minister, Ehud Olmert, called for a peace settlement, sharing Jerusalem, getting up the West Bank, exactly what I've laid out in my own book. And tragically, as I said, I don't think this is going to be realized because the right-wing parties in Israel have controlled the agenda, they control the U.S. political agenda in the Middle East, and they're not ready to start trading peace for land, or land for peace.
I understand in your book you discuss the treatment of women in Muslim culture. We in the West tend to think that they're oppressed. Are they?
In some countries, they are. In some countries, they're not. But where the oppression occurs is usually not so much the result of any religious belief, but of tribal customs. For example, in Afghanistan or in Pakistan. But you find similar abuses, or even worse abuses, in, let's say, India or in parts of China. We only focus on the Muslim issues because there's so much war propaganda that's been beaten up around this drummed up around this issue, but there are abuses. The women's rights are improving, and I tell you, it's a question of perception, too, because in the Muslim world, there's a general view that women are exploited and cheapened and debased and used as sexual objects in the West, and that women in the Muslim world are more respected and better off.
Talk to me about Al-Qaeda and why it is so popular. And do you think we in the West can ever defeat it? I mean, whether it's under the guise of this so-called war on terror or otherwise?
Well, Al-Qaeda was started as a tiny movement. I was in my book, I discuss, I was with the founder of it, the teacher of bin Laden, Sheikh Abdullah Azzam, in Peshawar in 1986. And it was a movement that started to fight communism and drive the Soviets out of Afghanistan. And he told me, he said, when we're done doing that, we're going to drive the American colonialists out of Saudi Arabia. Al-Qaeda is a movement. It's not an organization. The idea that it's a worldwide conspiracy is not correct. It was a tiny organization to begin with, never had more than 300 men. And it has like-minded groups popping up across the Muslim world who are not organically linked to Al-Qaeda, but they share its thinking. And their objective is to drive Western influence out of the Muslim world, to resist Western domination and to use their own resources. And this is going to continue until there are more democratic representative governments in the Muslim world and until the West stops exploiting some of the Muslim world's countries.
Can they work with the West, though?
I think they can. I mean, after all, these are the same people who were our allies during the war against the Soviets. The Saudis are very conservative Muslims. They're really almost in the same camp. There's no reason why we can't, but the problem is that, you know, all this language about demonizing all these people and terrorism, this terrorism, that, has made it impossible to deal with these people, but even more so to think about how to deal with them rationally.
Let's move on to Afghanistan. It is called the Central Front on the War on Terror. Do you agree?
No. The War on Terror, that term is a propaganda term which has no meaning. It's loaded with emotion, but it is absolutely meaningless. Al-Qaeda, as I said, was a tiny organization. It's no longer in Afghanistan. There may be a handful of people. They're long gone. It disappeared into Pakistan. Same with bin Laden. What we are fighting, what Canada is fighting in Afghanistan, are the Pashtun tribal people, the biggest tribe in the world. 30 million people spans the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan in both countries. They're in both countries. They're half the population of Afghanistan. Taliban is part of the Pashtun people. What we are fighting now are the Pashtuns. We're fighting a war against a tribe. And this is not about terrorism. Really, the reason U.S. troops are still in Afghanistan is to open a way through Pashtun tribal territory for major energy pipelines to come south from Central Asia, from the Caspian Basin, and bring energy out to the coast of Pakistan. And one writer, Kevin Phillips, has rightly called our troops and American troops in Afghanistan pipeline protection troops. That's really what they're doing.
In your most recent column in the Toronto Sun, you contend that Canada should pull out. And I think there's a in the press today, there's a general, I believe, from Britain who said...
Yeah, that's right. The British commander in Afghanistan said the war can't be won.
So, can Canada pull out? Can the West pull out of Afghanistan?
Absolutely. You know, nobody gave a hoot about Pakistan, about Afghanistan before, and once Western troops leave, nobody will think about it again. The idea, oh, it's going to turn into a hotbed of terrorism. Well, Taliban already controls half the country. You know, that's ample room for training any terrorists who can be trained in a basement in Buenos Aires just as well. That's not a rational argument. I've maintained all along that Canada has no business to be in Afghanistan. It was forced there by U.S. pressure, trade pressure. It got involved into combat because of the foolishness and ignorance of Canadian generals and because of the ignorance of our politicians who felt it would be a good political issue to rouse patriotism and flag waving on the right wing. And it has to an extent, but it's killing Canadians. And it's the wrong war in the wrong place. Canada has no interest in Afghanistan. It's not fighting terrorism, as I said. It's fighting Pashtun tribesmen. And most important, that Canada was adored and loved all over the Muslim world until it sent troops to Afghanistan. Now it's regarded as an ally of George Bush, as a killer of Muslims. And this has put Canada on the danger list and in the crosshairs of violent anti-Western groups. So it's injured Canada's security rather than aiding it.
Against a backdrop of this current election campaign in this country, will Canada pull out of Afghanistan, do you think? Will the West pull out of Afghanistan?
I think the West will eventually pull out of Afghanistan. It should. It needs to do it. Now, the Secretary General of NATO said that there'll only be a political settlement to this war. There could be no military victory. The current U.S. commander in Afghanistan just said the same thing last week. The British commander said, we're losing the war. We can't win it. Americans said they need 400,000 troops to pacify Afghanistan. This is a lost war. It's just a question of how long it's going to take. The problem, military men are saying that this war is going against us, but the politicians who got us involved in this unnecessary war cannot admit that they sent troops to their death in a foolish and mistaken notion about this war, and their political careers could be ruined by ordering a withdrawal. That's why we have great reluctance in Ottawa and Washington and Paris and other countries to face reality in Afghanistan, stop the charade about terrorism, and say it's time to get our troops out, let the Afghans settle their own problems in their traditional way.
Iran. There's a lot of posturing by Iran and the West towards it. What should we make of Iran the rhetoric has been ratcheted up quite a bit.
Yeah, if we could bottle all the hot air about Iran, we could run an energy business. there's hysteria about Iran, and there's a great deal of untruth going, and a lot of Iranian posturing and swaggering. Iran is not now a danger to the world. It has no nuclear weapons. It has no long-range delivery systems. It has no desire to lob missiles at the United States or Canada or Lisbon, Portugal. It is in a major confrontation with Israel, as it has been for a long time, over who's going to be the top dog in the Middle East. That's what that's about. Israel is not facing a Holocaust, as its partisans claim. This is a wild exaggeration. The Iranians are not maniacs or madmen who are going to lob one nuclear weapon, if they ever have one, at Israel and then be wiped off the face of the map themselves by Israel's indestructible nuclear forces, which are were probably the world's third most powerful. So we need calm in this degree, and the president of Iran keeps stirring the pot by saying extremely stupid and incendiary things, but Israel's leaders have been almost as bad in yelling about Holocaust and causing the Jewish population in North America to go into a panic when it's not necessary. Israel and Iran have a lot in common. They've been playing footsies for decades, and they can just as well go back to being allies as they once were as to being the worst of enemies today.
So what can the West do? What can the American government say do? I guess, will we see a different change in the new government that we expect next year?
I'm afraid not. The new government's policy has already been handed to, whether it's Obama or McCain. The only difference would be that McCain wants to take a very aggressive, he's called for attacks against Hezbollah and against Iran and against Hamas and any of the enemies of Israel, under the advice of Senator Joseph Lieberman, his eminence grise. But also McCain has called for confronting Russia, a very aggressive policy over Georgia, this foolish little war that the U.S. engineered and then got thoroughly whipped. And he's calling for confronting China. It's just too much. America is bankrupt. America's military is bogged down in Iraq. And McCain is still waving the big stick, but he doesn't have a big stick anymore. It's become a lollipop stick at this point, and God knows what's going to happen as this financial crisis worsens. America may just have no money to do anything.
Let's move on to Pakistan, because that's a fascinating place that we probably don't pay much attention to in the West. Is that an important region an important country to look at in the future?
It's very important. It's critically important. You know, my first book, War at the Top of the World, that I wrote about India and Pakistan and Afghanistan, trying to bring attention to this area before anybody was looking at it, I said the most dangerous nuclear confrontation on Earth is between India and Pakistan. Still, both nations are nuclear armed. Both of them have nuclear arsenals on hair trigger alert, about 3 minutes alert. Both of them are shooting at each other still as we speak along their ceasefire line in Kashmir. So that's a very dangerous situation. Now we see Pakistan in turmoil, with two of its four provinces in revolt against the central government, in the northwest frontier in Balochistan. And we see the war in Afghanistan slowly oozing into Pakistan's Pashtun, here they are again, Pashtun tribal territory, as the U.S. is mounting more and more ground and air attacks against these Pashtuns who are helping their cousins, their Pashtun cousins inside Afghanistan. And I'm afraid that the U.S., being unable to win the war in Afghanistan, in spite of its enormous firepower, in frustration, is going to start attacking deeper into Pakistan. Pakistan's army's chief leader has said that he will not tolerate American forces attacking and has ordered his troops to resist. So we're looking at the possibility of a clash between Pakistani and American troops. We're looking at a hugely confused tribal crisis in the area as America tries to buy and divide the tribes as it did in Iraq. And we're looking at the possibility of India intervening, a very scary scenario, a huge problem.
You knew and consulted with Benazir Bhutto before she was killed, is that correct?
That's correct.
Now that she's gone, first of all, was she Pakistan's best hope, do you think?
No, I don't think so, not necessarily, because she had a limited following, maybe 22-23% of the population. Her followers adored her. She was a very brilliant woman. But there were a large part of many Pakistanis did not. They regarded her as a tool of the West and too westernized. And the army never had any use for her either. The generals used to call her that girl. And this is translated to her husband, Asif Zardari, who was engineered with U.S. help into the presidency of Pakistan, is now Musharraf number two. And he's doing the same thing Musharraf did, which is renting part of Pakistan's army to the U.S. to go and fight these troublesome Pashtun tribesmen up on Pakistan's northwestern border with Afghanistan. He's now being called an American stooge, and he's also hated and detested by the army. And really, the real power in Pakistan is held by the army. So the situation is very bad. It's very turbulent and confused. There's been no improvement. I think things will only get worse.
As a foreign correspondent, someone who travels throughout the world, and you look at the world and all of its different pockets and conflicts and so on, are you hopeful at all for the future, or are you just a pessimist and just...
I'm basically a born-again pessimist, but I do get occasional glimmers of hope, not in Pakistan, that it is going to be one of our biggest headaches in the next couple of years. But, you know, I've been watching the Israelis and the Palestinians slugging it out for 50 years. I hope in my lifetime I see that problem resolved. I hope, pray so. I suggest a solution to the problem. It's not brilliant, it's obvious, but I still outline it in my book, The American Raj. And just on at the end of last week, Israel's outgoing prime minister, Ehud Olmert, came out with exactly the same plan that I've advocated in my book. It is a major step in the right direction. Unfortunately, it won't work, I'm afraid, unless America puts pressure on both parties. And right now, the American administration doesn't appear, or any new administration does not appear willing to have the political courage to do that.
After you leave Vancouver, where do you go next?
I go to Calgary and Edmonton and Toronto, and then off to New York and Washington.
And the next foreign stop is where?
Overseas?
Yeah.
Well, I'm due in London to do some broadcasting, too, on a media tour on my book. And then I'm off to Pakistan after that before the end of the year.
Listening to you this day about the book and about your many travels of 50 years in journalism, do you ever think of writing a memoir?
Well, I have, you know, and I'm glad you asked that because I am working on a book. Working title is Tea with Bin Laden and Holding Hands with Gaddafi. And it is a lighter-hearted recounting of my various adventures and misadventures in the Third World.
That sounds fascinating. But until then, we'll read American Raj. Thanks so much, Eric, for joining us today.
Great to be with you, and thanks for the great questions.
Thank you. The book is called American Raj, Liberation or Domination, $32.95 from Key Porter. EricMargulies.com is his website. It's a very fine website. You can find all of his columns and articles there, as well as media appearances. And in Canada, you can read him in the Toronto Sun. I do that online. For the commentary, I'm Joseph Flanta.